The reading tonight comes from Matthew chapter 8, verses 18 to 22, and that can be found on page 980 of the Church Bibles. Matthew chapter 8, starting at verse 18. Now, when Jesus saw a great crowd around him, he gave orders to go over to the other side. And a scribe came up and said to him, "Teacher, I will follow you wherever you go." And Jesus said to him, "Foxes have holes, and birds of the air have nests, but the Son of Man has nowhere to lay his head." Another of the disciples said to him, "Lord, let me first go and bury my Father." And Jesus said to him, "Follow me, and leave the dead to bury their own dead."
Well, may I add my welcome to Nigel's. It's very good to see you here with us this evening. We are nothing like full at St. Helens. Please don't think that we are. We'd love you to come back with plenty of friends next week. We can fit at least another 150 in here, for which I will get into terrible trouble on Monday morning. All of us are used to putting a price on things. Time, possessions, a job, qualifications, a relationship. All of us are used to putting a price on things. I wonder what price you would put on a place in heaven. Now, by heaven, I don't mean sitting on a kind of celestial cloud with a golden harp, wearing a white nightie and clip-on wings with fluffy bunnies like Paul was talking about. We've seen over the last few weeks that heaven is in some ways remarkably earthy. Heaven is described in the Bible as a glorious party to which people from every nation come, and Jesus has referred to that just in the last few weeks as we looked at Matthew 8. Heaven is described as a place of abundance with no more tears, no more sadness, no more suffering, no more pain. And Jesus has been presented in Matthew 8 as the one, the King, who will take away all pain, suffering, sadness, tears. Heaven is described as a place of perfect relational harmony. And over the last 4 weeks, we have seen Jesus give tangible evidence that he is the long-promised King of heaven. We've seen him cleanse the leper with a touch. We've seen him heal the centurion's servant with a word. We've seen him heal Peter's mother-in-law, raising her from her life-threatening fever. And we've seen him emptying the hospitals and doctors' surgeries of the surrounding towns as people came to him, were brought to him, and were healed. And we've said over the last 4 weeks that Jesus' kingdom is to be found where King Jesus is. So when he is physically on earth, we see his kingdom physically here. When he is physically in heaven, the physical reality of his kingdom is there in the new heavens and the new earth. Spiritually, he lives now in the heart of his people. He can be found here, and his kingdom can be found here spiritually in the hearts of those who trust him. In the future, when he returns, he will bring that glorious heavenly banquet where there will be no more suffering, no more tears, no more pain. The new heaven and the new earth. And I wonder what price you would put on your place there. First, this passage today tells us what price God puts on our place in heaven. That is, what it's worth to God, if you like. And the answer is a straightforward one. It is worth the death of his Son. That is, God is so concerned to have us in his heavenly kingdom under the rule of his Son, and he is so concerned for us not to be amongst those who experience the weeping and the gnashing of teeth for eternity in hell, that he is prepared to pay the price of his Son for us to be there. And that point is made for us in verse 20 of our reading today and in verse 17. And as we put those two verses together, as Matthew surely intended us to do, we will see that our being in heaven is worth to God the death of his only Son. So let's look at verse 21st. Jesus said to this scribe, who said, "Teacher, I'll follow you wherever you go." He said, "Foxes have holes and birds of the air have nests, but the Son of Man has nowhere to lay his head." Now, as Nigel has said, the Son of Man is the title that the Old Testament uses and that Jesus picks up and uses for himself. It is a title for God's Son, his King, the King over God's kingdom. And I'd like us to turn to page 900, if we could please now, so that we just have one more look and who this Son of Man is, page 900. Daniel chapter 7, verse 13. "I saw in the night visions," we're in verse 13, "and behold, with the clouds of heaven there came one like a Son of Man, and he came to the Ancient of Days," that's God, "and was presented before him. And to him," to the Son of Man, "was given dominion and glory and a kingdom that all peoples, nations, and languages should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion which shall not pass away, and his kingdom one that shall not be destroyed." Now, these then are, if you like, the heavenly rights of the Son of Man, God's Son, which is what we would expect, isn't it? That God's Son should be the rightful ruler and heir of all that God has. Now turn back to our passage and verse 20. Jesus says to this man who comes to him and makes this tremendous promise, "I'll follow you wherever you go," "Foxes have holes, birds of the air have nests, but the Son of Man has nowhere to lay his head." In other words, God's Son, the Son of Man, in his earthly ministry, relinquishes his heavenly rights. Not only his heavenly rights, his earthly rights. Indeed, his human rights. More than that, his animal rights. Foxes have holes. Birds of the air have nests. The Son of Man has nowhere to lay his head. He even lays his animal rights to one side. We talk of our creature comforts. There's no place like home, we say. Home is where your heart is. But the Son of Man on earth had no place to lay his head. What price does God put on our place in the heavenly kingdom under the rule of his Son? Answer, his own Son. One of the joys of being a parent of young children is the annual school play. I have to confess that even though one frequently has a vested interest in the events of the annual school play, it never is one of the great thespian highlights of the calendar. Sleeping Beauty for five-year-olds, performed largely by the teachers, actually, isn't exactly where the Oscars are going to be found. My father tells me of one occasion sitting next to a parent at a school play whose daughter's part consisted of being a bit of scenery. The play was performed at a boarding school down in Wiltshire, and at the end of the performance, the parent turned to him and announced, "I have driven all the way from Scotland to watch a tree." But for those small groups of proud mums and dads, you know, the muddled performance is a brief 30 minutes of sheer delight. I remember looking across at the performance about 5 years ago now, and there could hardly have been a dry eye in the house as hardened businessmen and what have you were watching their little ones. Imagine turning to one of those parents and asking them, what would it take for you to give up your son, your daughter, so that he had no human rights, no animal rights, no creature comforts, to be nailed to a tree for no just reason? I think the very question is unthinkable in one way, isn't it? I've got three children. I love them deeply. I'm embarrassingly proud of them on occasions. Try not to be. There is nothing I wouldn't do for them. To give any one of them up so that they had no rights. And yet God the Father is so concerned for you and me to find our place in heaven that when his Son comes to earth, he has nowhere to lay his head. Unlike the foxes and unlike the birds. It is a step down, isn't it? But I want us to look very briefly again at verse 17. We spent a lot of time at this last week, and I want us to look back at it because the putting together of verse 17 with verse 20 doesn't just tell us what we are worth to God, it also explains why God sent his Son. And I want us to revisit this verse and look at it again in the light of the Son of Man having no place to lay his head. For Jesus, God's Son, enables us to take our place in heaven through his selfless sacrificial death. And that is what I think verse 17 is doing right next, if you like, to verse 20. You remember that we said last week that Matthew, when he quotes from the Old Testament, quotes a verse but assumes the overall passage. And verse 17 makes the point for us because it comes from Isaiah 53, one of the great passages in the Old Testament about the death of God's suffering servant. Perhaps you turn back now to page 742 again. Verse 17 is Matthew's own translation of Isaiah 53, verse 4. This prophecy was made over 700 years before the death of Jesus. And let's read from verse 1 of chapter 53, shall we? Who has believed what they heard from us, and to whom has the arm of the Lord been revealed? For he grew up before him like a young plant and like a root out of dry ground. He had no form or majesty that we should look at him, and no beauty that we should desire him. He was despised and rejected by men, a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief. And as one from whom men hide their faces, he was despised, and we esteemed him not. Surely he has borne our griefs and carried our sorrows, yet we esteemed him stricken, smitten by God, and afflicted. But he was wounded for our transgressions, he was crushed for our iniquities. Upon him was the chastisement that brought us peace, and with his stripes we are healed. All we like sheep have gone astray. We've turned everyone to his own way. And the Lord has laid on him the iniquity of us all. Now you can see there the language of transgression, of iniquity, and of falling short. All of that language has to do with our failure to recognize God's right rule of our lives. And it assumes a vast gulf fixed between us and God. It speaks of a debt that has mounted day after day after day, as in our attitudes and in our actions we have pushed God off to the side of our life. Notice the language of transfer in verse 4 and 5. He took up our infirmities and carried our sorrows. Upon him was the chastisement, the punishment that brought us peace. With his stripes we are healed. Notice the language of substitution. He was wounded for or on behalf of our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. And notice the language of punishment that enables forgiveness. He was smitten by God. He was afflicted. He was wounded. He was crushed. He was chastised. Such that the price put on our place in heaven is this price of the debt that we owe to God through our rejection of him and our rebellion against him. And that price is paid by God's suffering servant. And by putting verse 17 next to verse 20, Matthew surely is indicating to us that this suffering servant who carries the guilt and the sin and the transgression of sinful men and women is this Son of Man who has nowhere to lay his head. The heavenly King has become the suffering servant in his ministry here on earth. This time last year, you will remember the bombings in Chechnya at the school in Beslan. I've mentioned from the pulpit here before that in amongst all the human tragedy and wickedness, there was one act of quite extraordinary love and bravery. Apparently, as a mother saw the guys about to detonate the bombs, she was there with her three small children and she threw herself over the three kids. The bombs went off. The roof collapsed. And as the rescuers came through just a few minutes later, they found the pierced and dead body of the mother and underneath the three children alive. Ask one of those three children today, what are you worth? What were you worth to your mother? What price your place in this earth alive today? And they will be able to tell you. What price your place in heaven? Well, God sent from heaven his only Son, the Son of Man, to whom all honor and power and authority rightfully belong. The Son of Man stepped down to earth as the suffering servant. He had no place to lay his head. He denied himself all his human rights, all his animal rights, all his creature comforts, as he went to the cross to bear our iniquity. I think it's worth pausing there for a moment. You know, I think our culture has come to assume that my place in heaven is almost a human right. The idea that I should take my place in heaven regardless of any debt I might owe to God, I think, is assumed by our culture. I don't know if you read the death of the genius, Ronnie Barker, this week. I'm part of the generation that grew up with porridge. The two Ronnies. I was one of the 18 million that used to tune in with all of our family to the black and white screen and watch the two Ronnies on Saturday night. I have no idea where Ronnie Barker stood with Jesus Christ. I hope he had a real Christian faith. But the assumption in the press is that there is no price to pay. For him to take his place in heaven, well, a lovely, genial, kind bloke like him, one of the headlines read, God obviously needed cheering up. Or Robin Cook. Robin Cook's been a great, brilliant politician, one of the best brains in the Labour Party. Spent all his life in clear and unambiguous denial of the existence of God, was a determined and professed atheist to the day of his death, and yet at his funeral in a church in Edinburgh, it was sort of intimated that, well, God needs a politician in heaven. You may have come across that wretched poem that people sometimes have read at their funerals. Death is nothing at all. I've only slipped into the room next door. I'm waiting for you. All is well. No sense of debt. No hint that there might be anything wrong between me and God. All is well. Well, I'll simply bowl into God's heavenly banquet and mix happily with my old buddy God, even if I spent all of my life denying his existence. We'll slap one another on the back, swill back a pint down at the local, even if I spent my life pushing him to the edge, and then we'll get on with eternity together. Our culture assumes that all it takes to get me into heaven is my death. Jesus teaches that what it will take to get me into heaven is his death. I wonder if you've ever paused to ask yourself what you are worth to God. What value does he place on having you in heaven? Can I ask you to do that this evening? As you brush your teeth, I mean, I assume you do that in the evening before you go to bed, but if not, tomorrow morning or next week, whenever you do that kind of thing. Look at yourself in the mirror if you can bear it, and ask yourself, what am I worth to God? You see, Matthew is wanting us to know, I think in verse 8, that this glorious, chapter 8 rather, this glorious king who is showing himself to be the heavenly ruler, this glorious king has come to earth as the suffering servant so that the Son of Man in heaven is the one who has emptied himself of all his glory and all his dignity, all his splendor, and has walked the earth with no place to call home, as he's carried your debt and mine in order that we can enter heaven. Well, let's move to the second part of the evening, which is much briefer. What price does God put on our place in heaven, his Son? What price, then, do I put on my place in heaven? And I want us now to meet the two characters that we're looking at in verses 18 and 21. And we'll go to the first one in verse 18, the man who I'm going to say promised too much too soon. When Jesus saw a great crowd around him, he gave orders to go over to the other side, and a scribe came up and said to him, "Teacher, I will follow you wherever you go." Now, I think his promise is understandable. He's seen Jesus in action. I think he probably has begun to realize who Jesus is, this glorious Son of Man, the King. He has watched him cleanse the leper. He's seen him heal the centurion's servant. He's been there as sick person after sick person and demon-possessed is brought to Jesus, and the doctors gawp in amazement as Jesus demonstrates himself to be the heavenly ruler and king. And so he goes up to Jesus as Jesus prepares to cross over to the other side, and he says, "Look, I'll follow you wherever you want." But I don't think he's realized that for the gate of heaven to be opened, there is a debt to be paid. And that in his earthly ministry, the Son of Man is going to do the work of the suffering servant as he heads to the cross to pay the debt on our behalf. And I don't think he's realized, therefore, that following Jesus now on earth will mean following one who has no human rights, no creature comforts, no earthly splendor or glory or power, And therefore Jesus says, hold on, don't promise too much too soon. When we go back to Isaiah 53, we find that the suffering servants had an appearance that was marred beyond human semblance. You looked at the suffering servant and you said, is he human? When you go back to Isaiah 53, we find that the suffering servants had no majesty or form that we should look at him, and no beauty that we should desire him. So that if you'd seen him, you would have said, people follow him? And when we go back to Isaiah 53, we find that the suffering servant was despised and rejected, a man of sorrows, acquainted with grief. Men hide their faces from him. They can hardly bear to look at him. He is despised and not esteemed. And if the king of the kingdom on earth has no place to lay his head, if on earth the king of the kingdom is despised and rejected and is not esteemed, then like master, like servant, following him here now as we wait for his glorious physical kingdom in heaven will result in rejection and shame and suffering and sacrifice. Don't promise too much too soon, will you? Don't think that, you know, if you make a decision tonight to follow Jesus, that as you go in and announce it in the office tomorrow morning, they'll say, wicked! Which I think is a term of, you know, having done something quite good, if I'm right in thinking. Or if you go home to your parents, if they're not Christians, and you say, look, I'm going to follow Jesus wherever he goes, don't think they'll say, good call. Or your mates at school or at college, I've become a Christian, I'm going to follow Jesus Christ, you know, how cool is that? Men hide their faces from him. He is despised and not esteemed. And as we follow him openly, we will find ourselves mocked. I could introduce you this evening to a doctor, a surgeon, who after years of opposition from hospital managers has finally lost his job in the hospital because of his open Christian stand. 10 days ago I was at a supper where now a CEO of one of the big insurance companies was speaking. On several occasions, I have been prevented from being promoted because I follow Jesus Christ. 2 years ago now, a girl at a photocopier expressed her Christian belief and views on a particular subject. She was asked the next day by the Human Resources Department to come and see them, and she lost her job. At a mission, at a boarding school, about 10 years ago now, a 14-year-old boy told me how he was woken at 3 in the morning, having recently become a Christian, with the rest of his dormitory around his bed, hoods of their dressing gowns up, chanting. I'll follow you wherever you go. Foxes have holes, birds of the air have nests. The Son of Man has nowhere to lay his head. And I think this has glorious integrity, doesn't it, in chapter 8? I mean, if you've been with us for the last week, you'd have said, I want to follow Jesus. This Jesus, I will follow him anywhere. And Jesus says, whoa, hold on a second. Do you realize, yes, I am the Son of Man. Yes, I will rule. Yes, the nations will bow down before me, but my earthly ministry is one of suffering and shame. And it's easy to be swept along at St. Helens. Big crowds. I'll follow him wherever. And Jesus says, pause, look carefully, wait. Make sure you know who I am. Investigate. Explore. Don't promise too much too soon. And then there's the disciple who promises too little too late. And it's great balance, isn't it? Verse 21, another disciple said to him, Lord, Let me first go and bury my father. And Jesus said to him, follow me and leave the dead to bury their own dead. Now, I think it is deliberately outrageous to make the point. It's designed as a warning against putting Jesus off or having him as just one among many other priorities. Jesus can't be telling the man to abandon rightful concern for his parents. He rebukes the Pharisees for failing to keep the commandment elsewhere. Nor do I think is he suggesting that we shouldn't necessarily go to the funeral of our parents. This is a classic rabbinic teaching aid. They used to use extreme to make the point. And Jesus' concern is to warn us against delay and to impress on us the need for him to be our number one priority. The man is in danger of promising too little, too late. I've got other things to do, Jesus. Next week, next year, next decade. I think he realizes who Jesus is. I think he's clear what Jesus is asking. But he wants to put off following Jesus and to attend to something else. The social life, the job, that promotion, the qualification. And Jesus says, stop putting it off. Don't think I can just be one priority amongst hundreds of other things. One day, burying your dad. Next day, playing golf. Next day, at the office. Next day, pursuing a relationship. Next day, oh, it's Jesus' day today. I remember a young army officer coming to see me at college a few years ago, a lovely bloke, Peter. He came to a couple of talks like this. He asked to meet with me for coffee. He said he wanted to follow Jesus. I spoke to him about what it would mean to follow Jesus. You do know that following Jesus means following him as the Son of Man, the Lord, King of Kings, Lord of Lords. You do know, don't you, it's no good saying, oh yeah, I'll follow Jesus just as so long as he doesn't interfere with my rights. I must have my creature comforts, you know. He can be part of the portfolio, just one interest amongst all the other interests. The girlfriend, the social life, the sport, the career. One egg in a large basket of commitments. And Peter turned away. Too little, too late. I think this is a great interlude, really, in chapter 8. We come to somebody who really does follow Jesus later in chapter 9, but this is a great interlude, isn't it? After such a spectacular few weeks as we looked at the King of Kings, it's a great interlude at the start of the year to remind us not to promise too little, too late. He's King of Kings. He's Lord of Lords. And as King of Kings and Lord of Lords, he seeks our all. What price do we put on our place in heaven, I wonder? The price God puts on our place in heaven is the death of his only Son. But his only Son is Lord. He is the Son of Man, the King of Kings. And he seeks those who recognize that as they follow him. Now, I'm going to pray in just a moment. And it may just be that you're somebody who has been just putting things off. And this evening might be just right for you to say, yes, I realize who you are, Jesus. Thank you for dying on the cross for me. Thank you that you are that suffering servant. And I want to follow you first in my life. If you haven't looked at it closely, please don't pray a prayer like that with me now. But in a group of this size, there are bound to be people who are saying, look, I've been putting it off. And I need to do something about it. And if that's you, then why don't you echo this prayer in your heart as you turn to Jesus as the Son of Man, the King of Kings, the Lord of your life. Let's pray together. Lord Jesus Christ, I recognize that I have been putting off turning to you and following you. I'm sorry. Thank you, Lord Jesus, that you are the suffering servant. You carried all my sin in your body on the tree. Thank you. Please come into my life as I turn to you now as my Lord and King. And please help me to follow you wherever you go. Amen.